Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Since 1982, and A is for Alibi, Sue Grafton has been spellbinding readers with her best-selling Alphabet series of detective novels, featuring private investigator and Grafton alter ego, Kinsey Millhone. 31 years later, she's at W, as in W is for Wasted, and she's made a big life, imagining murder and a whole lot more. This hour on Point, we're talking with crime writer Sue Grafton about a life in the trade, and her latest, and crime fiction now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you been there since A? Do the basics of crime writing change? Should they? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Tempe, Arizona, is Sue Grafton, best-selling crime novelist. She's won every accolade in the biz, including a couple of years ago the Grand Master Award from the Mystery Writers of America. Her latest title, W is for Wasted. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Sue Grafton, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much. This is great fun.
It's great to have you with us. You've been at it a long time. 1982, you started out at A, and people immediately said, that'll never go the distance, 26 letters of the alphabet, and here you are.
I know. Well, it did take people a while to figure out what I was up to. I remember doing D is for Deadbeat, and somebody said, are you doing the alphabet? I went, yes, ma'am, I am. So who knew I'd get this far?
Yeah, but here you are. It's happened. Listen, I want to talk all about this book, and I want to talk about your career. It's such an interesting career in the business, and to keep at it this long, and to keep going into new territory.
Exactly.
But can we just go right away to this? You got a little furious flurry going not long ago when you made some off-the-cuff remarks about self-publishing, which is, of course, huge these days. Lots and lots of writers are turning to it, sort of putting their own stuff up on the web. Or even on paper, self-publishing. And the headline was, you know, Sue Grafton says self-publishing is a lazy, sort of shiftless, amateurish. Man, did that get people upset. Here's a little bit off of YouTube, Sue. Yeah, we're in the modern world here, all kinds of media. And here's a couple of self-published authors reacting with anger to those comments. You've since kind of backpedaled and apologized and made nice. But off the original thing, here's Kristen Saitze and R.J. Keller taking to YouTube to voice their frustration with your characterization of self-publishing as lazy. Here we go.
Self-publishing is easy.
Oh, easy, yes. And lazy, too.
Lazy, yes. You can also call it lazy. If you don't query agents.
Writing query letters is not fun.
If you don't edit, if you don't.
Yeah, editing, definitely.
Revise.
I actually hired an editor.
I made flyers.
I had to work double shifts to pay for that.
All kinds of people up in arms in the self-publishing world where, after all, the whole gray thing came from there. What were you thinking when you went after self-published authors?
Well, all I said was about self-publishing, it almost spelled out you were too lazy to do the hard work.
What did you mean by that?
Well, I might as well have thrown a match into a gasoline can.
Yes.
In my backpedaling, what I did, because I never intended to offend anybody, but I grew up in a day where a vanity press was the last resort of people who couldn't get published any other way.
When you paid to have your own book published,
exactly.
Because no publisher would pick it up.
Exactly. And I've been working in isolation, so I'm not tuned in to YouTube and tweeting and twirling and all that stuff. So I was completely oblivious to the fact that, as a matter of course, many self-published authors are on the bestseller list and making a fine living. Thank you. So I had to correct myself with all due humility, and finally people have kind of forgiven me, I hope. But somebody will pull that quote up from a year and a half ago, I'm back in the soup.
You're going to have to eat that crow again and again and again.
I know. I repent my sins. I truly do.
If you dial this back to when you were first here, you came up out of Louisville.
Yes.
You were in L.A. You spent years doing screenplays.
Yes.
Didn't really like that. You were working on your own books on the side. You went through, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 novels before you got one published.
Yes.
If all the way back then you'd had the option of, you know, those early books, just putting them straight out to a readership instead of just praying that some publisher would have picked them up and run with them, do you think you would have done it?
No.
Why not?
Well, because I'm old school. In my experience, it is the process of rejection that teaches you to be tough. It teaches you to write better. My worry about people who go through these alternate methods of getting published, I'm not sure they get the kind of editing. I'm getting myself in trouble again. I'm sorry I said that. It's leading me down the path.
Generations talking here, but it's an interesting back and forth because you've been there. And you said then, and you're kind of saying now that, you know, too many writers complete one novel, start looking for fame and fortune. Sure they're entitled to. Maybe you're just out of a different time. I mean, maybe you don't have to suffer so long anymore to get through the gate. Is that necessarily bad? Were your first books so bad that they shouldn't have been self-published?
My first three novels, which were never published, that was how I taught myself how to write. It would be, I compare it to learning 5 easy pieces on the piano. You're not ready for Carnegie Hall. The process of writing and teaching yourself to write takes many years, and I don't think there's a way to shortcut that process. I am assuming there are some writers who come out of the gate with skill and talent and presence of mind, and I don't know what that percentage would be. Most of us struggle for a long time, and it's the struggle that teaches us.
So you had three rejected before you got one accepted. How many were out there before you began to actually, you know, make a living, quit your day job off of writing?
Yeah. Well, I was told early in my career it would take 5 years to get published and 15 years before you could support yourself as a writer. I had, as I said, the three books rejected. The fourth was published. The fifth was published. The sixth novel and the seventh novel, full-length works, were never published. The eighth book I wrote was A is for Alibi. At that point, I had never written a mystery in my life. I'd read my fair share, but it was what I was born to do, and that long journey was all as a means of teaching a craft that I now struggle with, even so.
There are many kinds of tone and approach to detective fiction. I suppose there's some real commonalities as well. Have you found, I mean, here you are very deep in the career. Have you found certain commonalities in the kind of personalities or worldview of detection fiction writers, Sue?
Oh, good question. Well, from my personal experience, mystery writers are some of the dearest, funniest, smartest people I know.
But of course.
I think as a group, we're generous. We're willing to help others come up behind us. And yes, I grant you, we're very sick people because we sit around thinking of ways to murder and thinking of ways to see that justice is done. So it's a peculiar lifestyle and life view, but somebody's got to do it.
You had some tough stuff in your early years. Two parents, you've been very open, who were alcoholic, who you say you felt essentially abandoned by age 5, not in fact, but...
Well, it was a benign neglect. I always had a place to sleep. I was fed. I was never abused. But in effect, I raised myself. Later, I have come to understand what a perfect upbringing that is, excuse me, for a writer. Because I had freedom and I learned to observe, that was how I survived. So those two factors, having that flexibility and that, you know, I had no supervision. So I was left to my own devices. I grew up in a neighborhood where kids played games and we invented scenarios of, you know, princesses and great adventures.
But it wasn't all Andy and Mayberry. I mean, you write, my father downed 2 jiggers of whiskey and went to the office. My mother, similarly fortified, went to sleep on the couch. From the age of 5 onward, I was left to raise myself. Did that give you the sort of, I don't know, the anger piece or the outsider piece that I feel
probably,
working in your work?
Yeah, probably the outsider piece. I think there was a certain detachment, but I did get to be a kid. I'm not sure kids are allowed to do that anymore. You know, in those days, I could wander the neighborhood. We had a park close by, 409 acres. I could wander there at will without any conscious worry about being snatched and killed.
We still hear a little bit of that Louisville in you. Are you more Louisville, Kentucky now, or more Santa Barbara, California?
We are now Kentucky residents. We just did that last week. I have my Kentucky driver's license. We're registered to vote. So we
Santa
do
Barbara
split our,
weeps.
Yeah. Well, we spend half the time in one and half the other, so we're just careful to count our days.
What whistled you home back to Louisville for half the time?
Well, when I left Louisville, I was just so thrilled to be across the state line. I needed to spread my wings. I needed to see what the world was about. Having spent a little time in Los Angeles and aged and matured, I realized Kentucky is a beautiful state. The people are so gracious. And after a while, I could see that I had erred in that regard also. So it's been fun. It's been fun to be back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with best-selling crime writer Sue Grafton, author of the Alphabet series of crime novels, A is for Alibi, etc., about her crime writing life, murder, homelessness, and her latest, W is for Wasted. She joins us today from Tempe, Arizona. Sue Grafton is a big name. She has sold an awful lot of books. People read her all over the world. She even makes it into all kinds of popular culture. I mean, you would have found her in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Somebody's reading Sue Grafton. In the 2000 episode of The Office, boss Michael Scott, played by Steve Carroll, decides he can drum up business by convincing Sue, who's with me now, to be in a commercial for his company. It's a complicated plot. She sort of blows off someone trying to get a signature. But here they are, talking about getting Sue Grafton into their commercial. Punchline, she's crazy hot.
I want you to get her to be in this commercial.
This would be a huge coup, people. All right? Do not take no for an answer.
Okay.
Does anyone actually know what Sue Grafton looks like? I mean, is she hot or...
She's crazy hot.
A huge coup to get you in there, crazy hot Sue. Did you enjoy that?
I did. I had not heard that clip. I was also in that movie Stranger Than Fiction. And there's a scene where Dustin Hoffman is reading one of my books. So naturally, I think it's a fabulous movie.
Of course. And Michael Blomquist in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Yes, exactly. And I'm often in the New York Times crossword puzzle because I have those wonderful blank
A-B-C.
Is for what, wink, wink.
Right. On and on we go. Take us into this latest one. Here we are. I mean, you've written so many.
Oh.
And one wonders, like, where do you keep coming up with it? But W, that you're 20 plus at this point.
Well, I always wonder where I come up with these. One thing I do, I keep a journal for each book that I write. Mm-hmm. And I have elaborate charts that I carry with me from book to book. So I keep track of the gender of the victim, the gender of the killer, the motive for the crime, the nature of the climax. I also have what I call a log line that I learned in television, where you just a one line telling what the setup of the book is.
Mm-hmm.
And that way I can look at that grid. And when I'm coming up with a new idea, I can make sure I'm not unconsciously repeating myself. Because one of my goals is never to write the same book twice.
I mean, you clearly pay a lot of attention to the world. You've got homelessness. We'll talk about that in here. Very empathetic sort of view of it in this book. You've also got pharmaceutical fraud. And a bunch of our pals are right here in your acknowledgments. Marcia Engel, who's in our backyard, who's been a frequent guest here. Former colleague of mine, the great Allison Bass, who has written about side effects and fraud and all kinds of great research that she's done. I mean, you really reach out to the real world to bring this in.
I do. I do a lot of research, and particularly with a subject like this. I don't personally think all the drug companies are evil. I understand their problems and their desire to develop products that are good for all of us, and that's expensive. So I don't see them as the villain. I think within any framework, there are people who cut corners, and that's closer to what I'm talking about here.
And, of course, it's always with Kinsey Millhone. You never strayed from your private investigator, private eye. And you never backed off describing her as very much like yourself, sort of yourself.
Indeed. Well, when I was doing all the research for A is for Alibi, honestly, at that point, I did not know what a private investigator did. I knew nothing about police procedure or California criminal law. So I was so far out of my element when it came to designing the protagonist. I thought, shoot, I'm going to play that part myself. The only thing I really know about is being female. So I was hardly making a political statement. I was out of desperation. I made this private investigator female.
Of course. And then I don't know how far it goes. I mean, but she loves peanut butter and pickles. Her parents were killed in a car wreck when she was five. Right. She was trapped with her dead parents in several hours in there before she was rescued. We can find our parallels there if we want.
Well, yeah, Kinsey owns one dress, and I'm happy to say I have more than one. She usually wears jeans and boots and a turtleneck, and she cuts her hair with a pair of nail scissors, which I promise you I did yesterday.
Why?
I'm out on
tour. Is that fashionable?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm looking at my hair, seeing these stick-out parts, and that's exactly. Right. Kinsey gets out her cuticle scissors and just has a go at herself, and she thinks she looks fabulous. So who are we to argue?
Would you read a little bit for us from W is Wasted, your latest, just to give us a flavor of her? And, of course, we've got dead bodies.
You do. This is from the prologue. Two dead men changed the course of my life that fall. One of them I knew, and the other I'd never laid eyes on until I saw him in the morgue. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator, female, age 38. I rent office space in a two-room bungalow with a kitchenette and a bathroom on a narrow side street in the heart of Santa Teresa. Population, 85,810, minus the two dead guys. Since I'm the sole proprietor and lone employee, I operate on a modest scale, supporting myself by doing missing persons searches, background checks, witness location, and the occasional service of process. From time to time, I'm hired to establish paper trails in legal, financial, or property disputes. On a more personal note, let me say that I believe in law and order, loyalty and patriotism, old-fashioned values that might seem woefully out of date. I also believe in earning an honest living so I can pay my taxes, cover my monthly bills, and tuck any surplus into my retirement account. When I reached the coroner's office, I was ushered into a bay with the curtain discreetly pulled around the ceiling track. Though curious, I wasn't apprehensive. I'd done a quick survey and could account for the people I knew and loved. There were those who orbited my world in a wider gyre, but I couldn't think of one whose death would have had a significant impact. The dead man was stretched out on a gurney with a sheet pulled up to his chin, so there was nothing of an intimate nature in evidence. He was not someone I recognized. His skin tones were gray, underlined with a pale gold that suggested liver issues of a profound and possibly fatal nature. His features had been softened and flattened in death, angles worn as smooth as stone over which water is poured for thousands of years. The human spirit does more than animate the face. It lends character and definition. Here, there was none.
Sue Grafton reading there from her latest in her alphabet series of detective novels, W is for Wasted, reading there from the prologue. And right away, we have the introduction to Kinsey Milhone, who's always there, and to the features of the corpse. All right, let's get straight into it, Sue. Elmore Leonard passed recently, of course. The great Elmore Leonard, right up there with you in terms of all kinds of sales and fans all over the place. He left behind his rules for writers, and I'm looking at number two, avoid prologues. Elmore Leonard says, I don't want hoop-de-doodle to get mixed up with the story. And here we are, you're reading from your prologue. What about it?
Well, you know, rules are made to be broken, and that's the fun of it with this genre, because there are all manner of ways to tell these stories. And I adored Elmore Leonard. He is by far my favorite writer of all time. And I love those old guys, Robert Parker and Donald Westlake and Tony Hillerman. Those were just great, great guys. And I learned from them, and I'm telling you, they broke the rules much more often than I have managed so far.
Can we look at a couple of his other rules? The next one is never use a verb other than said to carry dialogue. Do you use exclaimed or shouted or screamed?
Nope. Occasionally I will, but I don't get into that business. He shot back. She retorted.
Mm-hmm.
He proclaimed loudly. I do agree that you want dialogue explanations or modifiers to disappear. I think Elmore Leonard was also good about keeping his prose just trimmed down and clean. And that's something I admired about him as well.
He said use regional dialect, patois, sparingly. Do you ever get into it? I'm trying to think.
I try not to because, again, I think it's wearing
mm-hmm.
for the reader to have to think to herself, gosh, what? Do what? I like to just keep, you know, certainly there are people who speak in peculiar ways. And where possible, I suggest speech patterns, but I don't go on and on with dialect and strange spellings.
Everything is set in or based around California in your fictional Santa Teresa, off almost literally Santa Barbara.
Yes.
What about California speech? Do you give it to anybody anytime in there? Or is it just American dialect?
I don't notice that California has any particular speech patterns.
Valley Girls had a big run a few years ago, and.
Well, in Kentucky, for instance, there are some wonderful ways to say things. Mm-hmm. If you're angry at somebody who has offended you, you say, "She has really tore herself with me."
Okay.
That says it all.
Yeah. He also says, avoid detailed description of characters. Know them by their tones of voice with not one adverb, please. And Elmore says, don't go into great detail describing places and things. Are you on the same page with Mr. Leonard on that point?
So? Not quite. One of the comments I hear from readers is that my descriptions of scenes and actions are clear enough that they can virtually see what's happening. And I think some of that came from my work in Hollywood, which I didn't have fun doing it, but I did learn a lot. So I think the writer's job is to create pictures, you know, so that the reader can be part of the process.
Hey, let's bring our listeners in, if I may. Sue Grafton is with us, huge best-selling crime novelist with us from Tempe, Arizona. Her latest is W for Wasted. She started with A is for Alibi. And, Sue, there are a lot of people lining up to speak with you.
Oh,
Suzanne
good.
In Akron, Ohio. You're on the air with Sue Grafton. Suzanne.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hi, Sue.
Hello.
I've been following you since about 93 when I was living in Central California, and I quickly caught up with the series after another paralegal I worked with was recommending your books. So as a paralegal, I appreciate the detail that you use, and I love the development throughout the series.
Thank you. Well, I'm always out of my element when it comes to the law. My father, who was a municipal bond attorney, said to me, don't ever become a lawyer, you will be bored to death. But if I had access to a law degree without any effort on my part, I would line up in a heartbeat. I just admire the legal system and the system of justice.
Suzanne, what keeps you coming back? You've read them all, you say.
I have read them all, and I always wait for the next one. I'm thrilled that the next one is out. What keeps me coming back is I can't wait to find out what Kinsey gets herself into.
Usually some kind of trouble.
It's always something. Suzanne, thanks for that. Martha in Hull, Massachusetts. Martha, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Sue.
Hello.
I am a big fan. I've read all your books. I love Kinsey. And I also love Henry, her neighbor.
But
before I hang up, I just wanted to tell you about something that happened to me at the library.
All righty.
A few years ago, and I was standing in front of your collection, and a young man came up to me, and I thought he came to speak to me, which he did, but he said, I just want to tell you that I am in love with Kinsey Millhone, and I cannot get enough of her books. So do you know when the next one's coming out? And I said, I don't, but I'm sure if you come back, it will be here. So I just wanted you to know that you had a male following as well as female following.
Martha, let me ask you, with that young man, put yourself, try to, in his shoes, his boots, what is it about this character, the private investigator, Kinsey Millhone, that you do you think that might have a young male reader falling in love with her?
Well, I think it's her independence, but she's also got a soft side. She she appreciates the men in her life, although she's, of course, torn by getting any help from them. And she's emotionally, shall we say, stunted? I'm not sure.
Falling in love with that emotionally stunted.
It works for me.
She has trouble letting go, I think.
Yeah.
Because she has to be so independent and in control. And she's dangerous.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of guy wants to worry about a woman who finds herself almost being killed all the time?
Apparently the guy standing next to you right there. Martha, I appreciate your call. Sue, do you look to make Kinsey lovable?
No, I keep her down to earth. And what I find appealing about her, if I may speak to that issue myself, is that she's not pretentious. She's always got kind of a jaded eye, and she's willing to make fun of her own foibles and quirks. The other thing is, I'm not selling anything. I am not political. I'm interested in the psychology of crime. The only point I keep trying to make is, why the heck do we keep killing each other instead of going into therapy? So I think murder is an interesting issue, and I think there are 26 stories to tell about it.
Martha also points to Henry. That's Henry Pitts, the landlord of your Kinsey, 88 years old in the latest book. And she writes, when I first moved in, this is Kinsey writing, I was 32 years old and he was 82, an age gap I considered negligible. What's 50 years difference between friends? Now there's a non-standard view of age gaps, 50 years and no biggie.
Yeah. Well, and Henry's brother William and his brother Louis and Charles and his sister Nell, they are all prime players. People say to me, I hope nothing's going to happen to Henry. I'm going, absolutely not. And I say, Nell, who's only 99, why would she die? She's not even sick. So I would like to reassure readers that the Sibs, as we call them, will make it way beyond Z is for zero.
But this is almost a romance between your 30-something and your 80-something year.
Yeah, well, you'd be surprised how many letters I get from women readers who are in love with Henry. And my problem there is to keep him from being too perfect. So many books, I make him kind of cranky and out of sorts so he won't be too idealized. Mm. I'm in love with him. What can I tell you?
And there it is. We've got homelessness. We'll look at that. You say, you know, the homeless just have another way, and they don't want to be talked down to, looked right. down on in this book. In the eulogy, you've got a character who says, the homeless do not want our pity, nor do they deserve our scorn. We'll come back and look at that with crime novelist Sue Grafton. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with best-selling crime writer Sue Grafton, author of the Alphabet series of crime novels, A is for Alibi, and Right On Through. She has, at age 73 now, come to W is for Wasted, and of course it's still with her private eye, Kinsey Millhone, set in Santa Teresa, read Santa Barbara, California. This time, homelessness and pharmaceutical fraud in the middle of the story. Grew up in Louisville, Kentucky, a long time in California, now half back in Kentucky. So we've got some high-minded readers here. And Cliff is listening to this conversation and responds this way. He says, most of Western society is far too interested in crime and violence. And then he says, I think of what Simone Weil wrote. And he's got a quote here. Let me share it with you. He says, nothing is so beautiful and wonderful. Nothing is so full of sweet and perpetual ecstasy as the good. No desert is so monotonous and boring as evil, Simone Weil wrote. Then she goes on to say, but with fantasy, it's the other way around. Fictional good is boring and flat, while fictional evil is varied and intriguing, attractive, profound, and full of charm. Makes you, crime writers, sound devilish for making all that dark stuff sound so intriguing, Sue.
Well, there you have it. I couldn't have said it better myself.
You just go for it. But what about Cliff's complaint here? We're too interested in this. Do you have any sympathy with that?
Well, here's what happens in my life. I pick up my morning paper, and there is crime from one end to the other. And I am interested in that. I am interested in embezzlement and fraud and murder and mayhem because I think it says something about the human psyche. My job is to see if I can figure out what that is, which I haven't done yet. But I am fascinated by people who cross the line. I just don't understand it. I think in our hearts, many of us cross the line. You get angry with someone, you get divorced, which is always a nasty process. Mm. And there's a, you know, I think we are aflame with emotions that we try to keep in check. Clearly, there is a class of individual who can't contain their own dark matter, and they spew that into the world, and we are the victims of it.
You don't isolate them too much. I read you saying that you don't trust anybody who's always polite. You said everybody, including you, has a dark side.
That's true. I mean, and I have to say this, often it's women who are just so busy being sweet and polite and agreeable. And I look at that and I think, where is your soul, baby? You know, where is your spine? The object of the exercise in mental health field is to integrate your shadow with your persona. And that's what I think a lot of people have trouble doing.
You've written, we all need to look into the dark side of our nature. That's where the energy is, the passion. Yeah. You must have looked a lot at yours then. I mean, that's material. What'd you find in there?
Well, part of it with the process of writing, I think a computer screen is like a mirror. I am forced every day of my life to look at myself and look at humankind. And it is a frightening process. Most of us would prefer to think about happy thoughts, you know, all technicolor and pleasant. And I think what we need to come to terms with is the shadow in us. So part of what I deal with is that, although it sounds very intellectual and lofty, it translates out to, for my way of thinking, good storytelling. A murder mystery is just a well-crafted, well-structured story of a quite strong sort. So for my reading, that's one of the things I'm looking for.
Let's go to Joan in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Joan, you're on the air with Sue Grafton. Thanks for calling, Joan.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Sue.
Hello.
The reason for my continued reading of your series is varied. Kinsey Mulhoney is a very intriguing character. Your action is very compelling. Your novels are not overly wordy. You do not include extra scenes that do not contribute to the plot. I've been struggling with my own mystery novel for years. When I reread your novels, I have renewed respect for your writing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sure. Joan, thank you. Thanks for calling. One more. Janice, Athol, Massachusetts. Janice, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And hi, Sue.
Oh, I'm hello. So
I love you both. I want to thank you so much for getting me back into reading books. I'm a newspaper and magazine person. I worked in security, and they had this rolling rack of books that you could borrow. And I saw The A for Elephant. I said, oh, this looks good as a quick read. And, I just fell in love with Henry and his baking and her in her car living in the garage. It was just so awesome. And it's like, she's my friend. And so is Henry. And I thank you so much. And I'm looking so forward to reading Wasted. And you're awesome.
Thank you. Hey, I appreciate that.
Janice, you're sharing a lot of love. Thank you very much for that. One more. SJ in Ponca City, Oklahoma. SJ, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom. Hello, Sue.
Hello.
Well, I want to say that I am an aspiring writer and a big fan. My wife actually turned me on to your book several years ago, and when we take road trip vacations, we get the audio books and listen to those also. That's how we spend our drive time. One question I've got is, when you reach Z and you're done with Z, do you have any plans beyond that?
Well, here's the deal. I'll be close to 80, and I think it's time to party. So I figure what I'm going to do when I get to Z is for Zero is see what kind of juice I have left. I've watched writers continue to write long after the passion is gone. I don't write for the money. I write for the thrill of it and the suffering. But I will see where I stand and what's going on in my psyche. My life is about writing, and you must know that, too, from your own work. So I can't imagine life without writing. I can't imagine life without Kinsey Mulhoney, but We'll see.
Pat writes to us on Facebook, Sue Grafton, please tell me you won't kill off Kinsey in Z.
I will never kill it. I am Kinsey Millhone, and she's going to have a more life long after mine is extinguished, but I give her to you for eternity.
But I think I heard our caller say when they go on bird trips, forgive me if I got that wrong, caller, vacations.
I think he said road trips.
Road trips. Okay. Well, I mean, it brought birds to mind. You've got Kinsey out walking by the bird sanctuary in this book.
Yes,
when she finds right off the bat dead body, the homeless man kind of under a berm there.
Right.
And I think you've said, I mean, almost everything here is from something you do, that you take walks by the bird sanctuary.
Yes, I do. I walk on the beach. I'm big on walking. And what was fun for me is that in my walks along the beach path, there are many homeless who, you know, are laid out on the grass with their shopping carts and their possessions. Many, many, many of them are reading books. So that's something you don't think about. You think of the homeless as alcoholic and idle. But in my walks, I would often pass along paperback novels to them because they appreciated that. I also was part of a funeral service for one of the homeless who died. We call him Beach Bob. This was some years ago. So when I got to the end of W's for Wasted, I thought, let's just see what that looks like.
And what about this sort of, you're standing up here kind of as a champion, at least in the words of one of your characters, for the homeless. You say the urge to rescue and the need to condemn fail to take into account the concept of the homeless, personal liberty, which they may exercise as they see fit as long as their actions fall within the law. You say the homeless are not lesser mortals. The homeless have established a nation within a nation, but we are not at war. What got you up on your soapbox on that front?
Well, I am not, as I said, I'm not selling anything. I just think what has to be true is that we assume because we want to live in condominiums and houses and that everybody must want that. And therefore, if you're homeless, you must be nuts because you're not living the way we live. But we are in this country at liberty to lead lives as we care to, as long as, I said, we're not breaking the law or, you know, imposing on others. So I just thought it was time to clarify that. Just because I like my life as it is doesn't mean everybody has to live exactly the way I do. I think we should need some tolerance in there.
Let him be. We have, of all things, Kinsey calling from Watertown, Connecticut. Hi, Kinsey.
Oh.
You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Sue. How are you?
Okay.
I'm well.
Well, the reason for my call is because, of course, in my 38 years, my family has come to know, as have I, that the name Kinsey is so unusual. And when my grandmother started reading the books many years ago, we were all intrigued to know, why Kinsey? Why did you choose that name?
Wait, I missed it. Did you say you're named after
No, I'm not named. I'm not named. I was the first Kinsey, I think.
You think you're Kinsey before Sue Grafton came up with it?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm dying to know when she came up with her character and how she named her.
Sue Grafton, how about it? Kinsey, the name.
I will tell you that. When I was working in Hollywood, I was reading the Hollywood Reporter one day, and there's a column in the magazine is gone, given birth announcements, and there was a couple in Hollywood who named their daughter Kinsey. So I loved that name, and I just sort of snatched it and put it in my little bag of tricks. And later, when I was designing the character, I pulled that name out. So there is actually the original Kinsey somewhere in the world, starting in Hollywood, as far as I know. I've never met her, but I know she's out there.
I mean, those K names are great for girls. I've got a niece, Kylie. I've got a niece, Kenley. No Kinsey yet. I suppose there's still time.
I have a file full of little girls named Kinsey. And if you have a baby named Kinsey and you write to me, I send a little set of barrettes that say Kinsey. And your daughter will get a personal letter from Kinsey Millhone telling how to be a good person.
Kinsey, do not miss it. That sounds too good to pass up. Donna in Delavan, Wisconsin. Donna, you're on the air with Sue Grafton.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Sue, I just want to thank you so much for your writing. My mother died 6 months ago, and I spent as much time as I could with her playing Scrabble and talking with her. But when I couldn't be there, I would have books called in from the audio books, and yours was one of her favorite books. She was she had osteoporosis, and she was down to 65 pounds at the end and had macular degeneration, so she couldn't read your books anymore. But I just want you to know how grateful I am for the excitement and bigger world that you brought to her little room and her life at the end.
Oh, that is so touching, Donna. Thank you. Thank you for that. I mean, Sue, talk about a recipe for writer's block. Here you are sort of narrating Donna's mom out of the world.
Well, and in my view, that's a connection that can go on. You know, I know many daughters and mothers who connect through this character. I had a reader say to me once, at our dinner table, we never knew what to talk about until Kinsey Millhone came along. People will argue about her wardrobe and everything else, but I have received letters from many people who are going through chemo, broken bones, blah. You know, they're holed up in a hospital somewhere, and someone will give them one of my novels, and that starts them on this journey and sort of lifts them and gives them a way to escape from whatever's going down.
Donna, thank you very much for sharing that.
So sweet.
You give us a picture right there. And you've joked, I mean, you said you'll be 80 by the time Z comes along, and you don't write way out in advance, so I assume you've still got some labor to put in to make that happen.
Exactly. I'm struggling with X. I mean, sometimes it takes me a year to come up with the storyline, just figuring out how the story's going to work. Yeah. So it's very unpleasant and uncomfortable, and one of my strengths is my willingness to tough it out, sit there until I figure out what I'm doing.
She's very much still at it. Sue Grafton is with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Have you figured out X is for what? Do you ever tell that in advance? People must wonder. X has got some limited options.
Yeah, it's got to be xenophobe or xenophobia as far as I can tell. Xylophone is not a crime, I keep saying.
Right. Your allergy to seeing your books up on the big screen, and such a deep allergy that you have joked that you would come back and haunt your children.
Absolutely.
If they ever do it. Why? What's the big deal?
When a Hollywood producer or any film person buys the film or television rights, they buy the right to the character in perpetuity throughout the universe and technologies known and technologies yet to be invented. The minute they cast the part of Kinsey Millhone, most of my readers are going to be up in arms, because when women look in the mirror, they see Kinsey Millhone, and it ain't Sandra Bullock or Jennifer Lawrence. You know, there are many, many fine actresses, but I don't want an image attached to Kinsey Millhone, because that will interfere with the reader's visualization of that character.
I mean, a lot of books have survived that somehow.
And a lot have not. Trust me. You know, I don't want to give up my power, plain and simple. The minute a dollar changes hands, I have handed over my life work to somebody who has a whole different set of ideas, and I ain't doing it.
Sue Grafton is not giving up the power, not to any Hollywood committee. Virginia in Bruce Crossing, Michigan. Last call, Virginia, you're on the air with Sue.
Hi, Sue.
Hello.
I just want to tell you thank you from the bottom of my heart for your books. They're so real. And for your comments about the homeless, because I have been homeless with my children, and I went homeless on purpose to avoid having to take drugs, psychiatric drugs.
You're right on
with the dignity, and we don't want your pity, and we don't want your handouts.
Exactly. Well, at one point, I'd say, you know, the homeless want ordinary conversation. Let's just relate to one another and be decent human beings together.
Yeah, it's no picnic, but it was a choice for you, Virginia. Sue Grafton writes about others for whom it is a choice. It's a matter, in some cases there, of liberty and pursuing liberty.
Well, and certainly there are many homeless who have problems with alcohol and mental illness, but not all of them. You know, some are there. Everybody's there for a different reason.
You know, you've always kept it in the 1980s. You never let it roll forward. Why is that, Sue?
Well, the books are sequential, so I kind of painted myself into a corner on that score.
You could have let her age right along with you.
Yeah, but now if she aged at my rate, she'd now be 63 years old, and it would start being ridiculous.
Diana Nyad says never give up. You can swim from Cuba to Florida. You can't be a private investigator at 63.
Oh, sure, but in fictional terms, I think there's a little credibility issue as we age, and I think it's more fun to keep her in her 30s, vigorous. We're not going to watch her go through menopause, kids.
Well,
you know.
She pulls out some pruning shears or something at a critical point
in
this book.
Oh, yeah, that was good.
I don't think you'd do that at 63. That was some dust up there. Oh, Kinsey's still in fine fiddle for fighting there.
Exactly.
Sue Grafton is author of the Alphabet series, A is for Alibi, right through her latest, W is for Wasted. Sue, in Tempe, Arizona, thanks so much for being with us today. Thank you for joining us.
What a treat.
What a treat for us as well. Sue Grafton. Thanks for joining us today, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.